Kia ora I te whānau, ngā mihi nui ki a koutou, kona ki hiso tōku ingoa. He aha nuku ahau I te rōpū ingarihi I te hiringa waka. My name's Nikki Hessel. I'm an Associate Professor of English at Victoria University, Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And in 2018, I published a book with Paul Grave called Romantic Literature and the Colonised World, Lessons from Indigenous Translations. And the book looks at Indigenous language translations of work by major British Romantic authors in Aotearoa, New Zealand, in Hawaii and in Kerala in southern India. And it attempts to account for how Indigenous translators or white translators using Indigenous languages translated British Romantic texts into ways that localised, domesticated them, made sense of them in the colonial conditions, but also tell us something about the way the original English texts were composed, what kind of colonial knowledge and pressures were operating on the British canonical writers when they composed the original English texts. One of the reasons translation seems to me to be a really central and important activity for decolonial work and also for even for people who work in British Romantic studies, it probably comes from the fact that my own country was founded on a translation problem. In February 1840, British colonial officials and Māori chiefs in the northern part of New Zealand signed the Treaty of Waitangi, which is the founding document of the modern nation-state of New Zealand.
On the way to the Bay of Islands to commemorate the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi, New Zealand's cruiser Royalist, with the frigates Carniere, Rotuiti, and the Australian training ship Swan, carry out exercises. Through these waters, Captain Hobson sailed in 1840 in a small wooden sailing ship. He had no long-range guns, no radar, electronic predictors or emergency towing systems, but he brought the order and protection of the British flag. Under the Union Jack on the lawn of James Busby's official British residence, 52 Maori chiefs signed the Treaty of Waitangi. Two independent seafaring nations laid the foundations of a new dominion. The Navy motor launch starts festivities with a trip around the bay for the local children. If only their ancestors could see them now.
And as any New Zealand school kid can tell you, there are two versions of the treaty, one in English and one in Māori. That's not surprising. The British would translate documents like that for Indigenous people to comprehend and to agree to. But the two versions do not say the same thing. In the English version, Māori cede sovereignty to Queen Victoria, to the British Crown, but retain control of their lands, forests and fisheries. They can retain control of all their property. But in the Māori version, Māori will cede kawanatanga, that's a transliterated compound word. Kawana means governor. There was no Māori word for governor, so kawana is the transliterated word. Kawanatanga is governance. So they cede governance, but they retain rangatiratanga. Rangatira means chief. Rangatiratanga is chieftainship, sovereignty. And so Māori understood themselves to be giving up control of the settler population. That is, a settler government would control the settler population, but they would retain absolute sovereignty over not only property, but themselves and the running of their own society. So that fundamental translation problem is at the heart of the country I grew up in, and it's at the heart of ongoing disputes, controversies, problems with the modern New Zealand nation state.
If only their ancestors could see them now.
So I don't think you can grow up in a country like New Zealand, a colonised country, and not feel that translation is important. That translation is not just a question of aesthetics or vocabulary. It's a political decision, and it has unbelievable political consequences for people, what these words mean and how they're deployed.
Hey!
For centuries, the Maori of New Zealand developed a distinctive culture, expressing themselves in boldly executed carvings, intricate and colourful weaving, and characteristically robust action songs. Today, to help preserve these skills, a few eager young leaders have assembled the now famous Maori Mormon Choir. Their energy and talent has resulted in the choir being asked to play a major role in the establishment of the Polynesian Cultural Center in Hawaii.
I came to the topic of the book slowly. I was struck as a student when, this is in the 1990s and early 2000s, and British Romantic scholars were beginning to talk a lot more about race and colonisation. But I was always struck by how often they described colonisation as if it was an experience that had happened to the British, that what was important about colonisation was how it shaped the British, their intellectual world and their writing, of course. And coming from a colonised country, that seemed to me extremely odd. I don't know whether it's because I was outside the Anglo-American Academy. I couldn't quite grasp why that was the thing that people wanted to focus on. And the real absence of Indigenous peoples from that discussion, or where they were part of that scholarship, they were mentioned as a kind of mass. That seemed to me to be a very odd way to conceptualise why colonisation is so central to the British Romantic experience. When that scholarship moved on in the mid-2000s, and there was a real move to talk about Indigenous peoples as individuals, but also as nation states, and to name these people and to look at local conditions and so on, that was obviously a big step forward for Romantic studies. But I was still aware that what we were accessing when we talked about Indigenous writers in the 19th century, Indigenous politicians, a transatlantic elite that is communicating with the European powers and with the settler governments, was always Anglophone. It was always in English. So that partly meant that we were only getting a tiny fraction of what Indigenous people might actually have thought about Romantic literature and culture, but also meant that we were not getting the most important bits of the information, it seemed to me. If you are only interested in what a colonised people express in English, you are missing 99% of the intellectual world of those people. English language expression is important and valid and should be included in those discussions. It's just that it's not everything. And of course, there's a methodological and cultural reason why scholars approached Indigenous writing and Indigenous people in that way in Romantic studies, and that is that we are almost all white, we are almost all Anglophone, we are almost all monolingual. And so anything else remained outside our expertise. It was not in any way, I think, accessible to us. But that is an extraordinary problem, it seems to me. It's a problem for ethical reasons. It's a problem because the reason that we dominate the academy is itself to do with settler colonialism and with our privileged position. But it's also a methodological problem. Are we content to have an impoverished knowledge because we stick with one language and we only value the sources that come to us through that language? Or would we like to be more knowledgeable? And it's one of the strange things about the academy that sometimes we don't want to be more knowledgeable. Sometimes we don't want to learn new things or change our way of doing things in order to push back the boundaries of knowledge.
I'm going to take you on a journey into the human imagination. Back to a time when the values and ideas and dreams of the modern world were born. 200 years ago, monarchy was falling to the power of people's revolutions. Industry and commerce were becoming the driving forces of existence. And advances in science were changing the way life itself was understood. Artists all over the world were inspired by these times of dramatic change. In Britain, a group of poets and novelists pioneered an alternative way of living and of looking at the world. Among them were William Wordsworth, Mary Shelley, and William Blake. The enduring power of their writing haunts us to this day and inspires us still with visions of nature.
So I began to sense that there was room in my field, and maybe more than room, there was an absolutely urgent need in my field for a work that would think about not just Indigenous responses to Romanticism in English, but within Indigenous languages. And I had no idea, embarking on the project, how much of this material might actually exist. I just had a sense that it would be out there, because why would it not be? To assume that people don't produce all sorts of criticism, intellectual work, analysis in their own languages is a strange assumption. And I think you should start from the assumption that people are doing that work, whether or not you can see it and access it. So that was my kind of starting point for feeling that this book needed to be written in my field. But there was then the important ethical question of whether I was the person who should be writing it. And that brings us, I think, to the really significant ethical question that all white scholars, all settler scholars in the Western Academy need to confront if they're handling Indigenous material. My position's an unusual one, I guess. I'm a Pākehā New Zealander. Pākehā is the Māori word for New Zealanders of European descent. I'm also the mother of bilingual Māori children. So I live in a bilingual household. And that gives me, I'm wary of the idea that you somehow magically have extra insight because of these personal connections. But there are aspects of my life that have introduced me to ways of thinking and approaches that I think have shaped my intellectual work, my scholarly and critical work. In terms of my Pākehā identity, I'm on both sides of my family descended from colonists, obviously here in New Zealand. My family has settler connections through New Zealand's European history. But in one line of my family, I have a colonial connection to India. My grandfather and great-grandfather were both born in India, in the Raj. They were British. And so my family's pretty embedded in the colonial life of the Pacific and of India. And that, I think, doesn't give me special insight so much as it gives me special responsibility to think about how my work and skills are deployed around issues around this part of the world. And in the book, I sort of roughly describe it as two oceans, the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean. Obviously, transatlanticism is a massive scholarly movement generally, and particularly in Romantic studies, a powerful scholarly movement. But perhaps because I am not from the Atlantic region, I sometimes want to push against the idea that the Atlantic is just like a big lake that we all live around the edges of. There are actually other oceans where important things happened, and transatlanticism is important, but there are many other kinds of communities in the world that are important too.
And then there were my father and mother, two people who could find an argument in any subject.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me you think the Atlantic is a greater ocean than the Pacific?
No, have it your way. The Pacific is greater.
I mean, how many people fight over oceans?
So part of what I felt would be really important here is to train myself methodologically, not just to do this work, but to even take the step of committing to doing the work, even at the point where I was still trying to decide, am I the person to write this book? I did a lot of methodological reading and around the kind of key point that so often white researchers are using Indigenous material without any consultation, without any advice from within those communities, and without providing any benefit back to the community. And that was the thing that I needed to grapple with, I think, methodologically. Translation's absolutely key to that. If we think about Spivak's phrase, translation as violation, where she talks about the way in which Indigenous knowledges are plundered across the colonised world, translated into English and then just used freely by Anglophone people. And that was something I was keen to reverse. Instead of thinking about the translation of Indigenous knowledge into English, what would happen if we thought about the translation of English knowledge into Indigenous languages? It somewhat mitigates that question of violation, although it doesn't remove us from the sphere of violence. If you think about why Indigenous people have access through the 18th, 19th, early 20th centuries to British literature, it's precisely because of the violence of colonisation. The presence of English people at all, the appropriation of land and resources, and crucially, of course, colonial education systems, often explicitly physically violent in their execution, but also epistemologically violent. The attempt to brainwash an Indigenous population with colonial knowledge. So although we can think about reversing translation as violation, we need to remember that that doesn't mean we're outside the sphere of colonial violence. It does have the advantage, I think, though, of allowing Indigenous voices to speak on their own terms. What texts did Indigenous translators want to translate? How did they translate them? What scholarly and editorial apparatus did they wrap around those translations? Why did they think readers who were either not Anglophone readers at all, or who chose to read outside, who could read in English but chose not to, why did they think they should be reading these texts that were originally in English? And I think that centres some voices that we otherwise don't hear from. I spend a lot of time reading Indigenous scholars talking about methodology. And of course, the absolute foundational text here is Linda Tuhiwai-Smith's Decolonising Methodologies, now nearly 20 years old, but a masterpiece and well worth your time if you've never read it, which talks about both the absolute violence of Western research methods on Indigenous communities and the need for Indigenous-derived research methodologies and the steps that non-Indigenous researchers can take to mitigate some of this. It's not the only work on Indigenous methodology, but it's an important starting point.
So without further ado, let me introduce Linda Tuhiwai-Smith.
Tēnā koutou katoa, greetings in my own language. The beginning of decolonising methodologies has always been about trying to understand our colonising experience and trying to understand it not just as a history that was taught oh so briefly in school. It was first there was us, then the British came, and our lives were forever changed for the better. And I think my, you know, undergraduate journey, I was a history major, but at that time in New Zealand history wasn't taught. The history that was valued was British history and European history. So I actually learned about imperialism through European history. And it wasn't until I left undergraduate studies that a major in New Zealand history was established in New Zealand. Believe it or not, New Zealand history is not compulsory in our schools, and where it is taught, teachers still have the option of teaching New Zealand history. So that denial of history is a very powerful part of the way we, our country learns to deny colonisation and didn't deny our experience. And as you know, when that experience is denied and it's real, you develop a number of kind of psychological and sociological kind of frameworks for trying to make sense of that.
All sorts of things came out of this methodological reading. One, of course, that you have to pay people properly for the work that they do. The fact that we imagine that it's okay to ask translators or linguists or cultural experts or knowledge keepers to give us that information for free, that it's okay just to thrust a text in front of someone and say, "Can you translate this for me?" tells you that we don't actually value that knowledge very highly. If we valued it, we'd pay for it properly. So if we're going to rely on Indigenous communities for the language and cultural skills that we do not have, that must be paid for in an appropriate way. So that important redeploying of academic resources, we may think of ourselves as underfunded, but of course we have access to research funding that a lot of people can only dream of. That is a really important step. It's important that the people, the translators and linguists and experts you're talking to actually do come from those communities. There are plenty of people who do have expertise, but they're not from within the community. And that became for me a really important foundational idea. Sometimes, of course, people did donate their time, colleagues did help out, did give me advice, and I'm very grateful for that. But I think you have to take the principle of the right people being paid appropriately as absolutely significant and important. I tried where possible to present with the translators and linguists. So if I was giving a talk or a conference presentation, to do that as a joint production so that both sets of expertise were being acknowledged and recognised and taken seriously rather than just mine. And of course, we're all aware now more and more of the importance of who we cite. Who do you consider to be an expert on your bibliography, and where did the balance of your citations lie? I tried to think hard about how to source information from Indigenous scholars, thinkers, writers, community leaders who'd put this information out in the public, and they should be leading the bibliography. Doesn't need to be exclusively, but where does the balance of your citations lie? Who are you trusting as reliable sources? It was important to me not to present myself as an expert on either these languages or the cultures from which they emerged. I don't have that expertise. I can't in any ethical way present myself in those terms, and I'm very resistant to being cast in that way. What I am an expert on, though, is British Romanticism. That's what I actually know something about. And it's where my expertise lies. But it's also, of course, where my own cultural knowledge lies, where my own linguistic expertise lies. These are the values and the inheritances of my ancestors that I do understand and can speak accurately for. So what I wanted to achieve in the book was not actually to say, here's everything you need to know about Indigenous language translations. It was more to say, with the help of people who understand these things, how do I turn back to my own culture, the texts of my own culture, the treasured words of my own culture, and see them differently and say something different about them? And that's why it was important to me to subtitle the book Lessons from Indigenous Translations. I think the translations teach you some lessons about what those texts say in English. You can't read them the same way once you've read the translations because they are fundamentally different. It doesn't matter to me particularly whether or not the original English authors knew this stuff. I think it's there. I think it's woven into the lines of poetry, the lines of novels, is that understanding of the colonial world and the grappling with the ethics of the colonial world, and it comes out very forcefully when Indigenous language translators tackle those texts. Even then, I think there's a real methodological danger, because what I did in the book was to go back to the English text, and that can end up being a recentering of British perspectives, Anglophone perspectives, settler perspectives, and so on, so that we're using the Indigenous knowledge as a kind of pathway to recentering ourselves.
So I just want to change the view a bit, not think just of decolonising the institution, but what did it mean to change the way we thought about research and thought about knowledge? This photograph here is actually a welcome to the French philosopher Derrida, who's the figure in the grey suit. But this is not really about him. This is slightly a deconstruction of the context. Because you will see, I took this photo, so you will see from my position where I'm standing. All right, so I'm standing behind the group that is welcoming Derrida onto our space. And you will see that between the group that Derrida is part of and our group, there is a space. And that's that space over the next few minutes or next 40 minutes is negotiated through a series of protocols that walk Derrida and that group across the space to where we are. And it seems to me that space of negotiation is a really important space for trying to shift the where the, I don't want to use zones, but where the centre is. It's easy to think it's all about Derrida, but in this particular ceremony, it's all about the space. And it's about moving people through space, through a series of protocols that then join people together. And I thought, you know, when you're thinking about changing, how do you change a perspective? It's really trying to understand that space in which perspectives are created and shaped and formed and in which they interact. This is another photo I have. I have lots of these where I stand behind people and like, they're mostly not very good photos. But there's this other, I guess, illustration of starting to look at ourselves, but with new eyes, different eyes, thinking about ourselves, not in the negative and not even in the grievance mode of being a colonised people, but how do we think about ourselves as sovereign people, as people who have a history, who value knowledge, and who have a future and want to define that future? How do we begin to reframe ourselves as self-defining people?
There's not much I can say about that other than to say that I'm aware of the limitations of it. I'm aware of which community I can speak for with some validity, and that I can only try to do the kind of work that I've been trained to do here. That's the thing I have to offer my field. That comes from thinking about what work settler scholars need to do on themselves. I come from a system here in New Zealand where my education is funded by the taxpayer. We pay fees here, but we have a heavily subsidised university education system. I then went to Canada to the University of Toronto on a Commonwealth scholarship, so funded again by taxpayers and explicitly evoking the language of empire, the Commonwealth as the successor to the British Empire. So in both cases, I was funded by taxes from New Zealand and Canada. What is the tax base of those countries? Well, it's a tax base that comes from stolen land. the New Zealand government, the Canadian government, they're only able to tax the land because they took it. And so you have already, through the process of being taxpayer funded, you've already benefited from colonisation and from stolen Indigenous land. And one thing I think we can usefully do, particularly those of us like me who are now on publicly funded salaries, so still being paid by the taxpayer, is to think about how we're going to make some payback for that. What is the reparation going to be here? What is the return on Indigenous people's investment in me, which they had no choice about? They didn't choose to invest in me. But nevertheless, that is what has happened. So what is the return I'm going to offer on that investment? And a lot of that, of course, is equity work. It's work around decolonising the academy. It's work on myself in terms of language acquisition and becoming a better citizen and a better scholar. But it's also, I think, in a more narrow sense, taking the specific skills and knowledge that were placed in me and putting them to work. I really only know how to do one thing, and that's literary analysis, and it's work in British Romanticism. And so if that's something I can offer back usefully, that might fill in a bit of the puzzle for some people. Why these texts? What did it mean for the ancestors to want to translate these texts? What were they trying to do? What kind of knowledge would they have been getting from British Romantic texts? That's a tiny, tiny contribution, but it is the one that I'm prepared to make. I'm in a position and trained to make. And so it still seems to me to be something that's worth doing. I also took a lot of inspiration from a book called Unsettling the Settler Within by Paulette Regan, who's a settler Canadian. And that idea of unsettling yourself as a settler is so important. The word itself tells us, I think, in English, that it is to do with comfort and convenience and not being not being discomforted in any way. And I think that's absolutely key to settler identity. We dislike confrontation. We dislike anything that jolts us out of the complacent privilege that we have. And unsettling that is really important. It's really important to be honest about the history of your own country. And as I said, in my own family's history, the global network that takes part in. Acknowledge how that privilege has got you to where you are today. But given that the past can't be erased, focus on what today and tomorrow you're going to do with that privilege. There's still time for us as settler scholars to do better, to do more. And of course there are going to be mistakes and errors along the way, but there's still time to make those mistakes and learn from them. I'm always a bit embarrassed when people praise the methodology of my book, because I feel that it's actually a very limited methodology. It's something that I worked out as a workaround for all the problems I could see in my own field and what I felt needed to happen. But it really would be my great hope for the book that it gets superseded, that someone reads it, an Indigenous student somewhere reads it and thinks, I could do better than that. I could make a better case than has been made here, and there are problems here and they can be worked through in a scholarly sense. So while I'm proud that I wrote it, my great wish would be to see people push beyond what I did here. I didn't really have an obvious framework to draw on, and so I had to invent it, and that will mean that there are all sorts of problems with it.
Turn of the Maori is to honour the Queen, their highest chief. At Waitangi, Her Majesty is challenged by a chieftain who lays a stick representing the sea god at her feet. The crowd swarms forward as the royal visitors walk behind the chieftain to the site where 113 years ago the Maoris ceded their land to Queen Victoria. Now, in welcome to Queen Elizabeth,
Ritual chants are sung by wives and daughters of Maori chiefs. To salute the Queen, the menfolk perform a fierce war dance.
In terms of what the content of the book aims to do, it's not really aimed at explaining Indigenous language translation or the body of written work of Indigenous populations. I'm obviously drawn to romantic texts because of my training, and that means I'm looking at only case studies and only small examples. But there's such rich examples in terms of what Indigenous language translators invested in those texts, what they could perceive. I was always struck through the process with how 100 years ago, 150 years ago, people could see something in these texts that now would seem kind of obvious to us, but only because we've moved into post-colonial theory and so on. They saw that romanticism is fundamentally tied up with colonization, and they saw that there was something about the British Romantic period that drew out impulses, language, forms that were tied to colonial experience. I became really interested in what in the book I call the fault lines in the translations. That is, mostly these are really faithful translations. They're very, very accurate. And then suddenly they're not. There'll suddenly be a word, a phrase, a line, sometimes even a longish digression that is not what the original English says. And far from seeming to me like a problem or an error or a kind of failure of the translator to grasp something or be able to express something, I began to see that the pattern here was that those moments were often the moments when something very profound happens in the original English, and the only way to get it across in the Indigenous languages is to be equally profound. But that sometimes meant not sticking faithfully to what the text said. It meant inventing something within the language that would make sense to an Indigenous reader. It's as profound as this from our culture and our language. So whenever I came across moments where the linguists would say to me, or the translators would say to me, This is what it says in the Indigenous language, but look, that's so different from what it says in the English. And we would puzzle away at why that was. Sometimes they're straightforward things. The localizing of place names or the names of plants, for example. But it's still really arresting because it does drag you into a colonial geography and a colonial mindscape that is not there in what, say, Wordsworth or Keats or Burns is writing. And those are such important moments, I think, because they get at something very profound in the original English text. They show, I think, not in fact a kind of misunderstanding or lack of comprehension, but almost the opposite, a very deep comprehension of what those texts are doing. And it doesn't totally surprise me. I think if you look at the Romantic period, it's obviously a period of massive imperial expansion on Britain's part. Again, it happens to link very neatly with the period from when Captain Cook arrives in the Pacific through to the point where the Treaty of Waitangi is signed. So it happens to coincide with the period of early colonisation of my own country. But I don't think that is a coincidence. I think that's precisely the point of a book like mine and of the translations themselves, is there's a very obvious overlap here between romantic intellectual endeavour and literary production and what is happening in the colonial world. And romanticism is perfectly placed to help us untangle and articulate some of what happens in the cross-cultural communication of that period. The misunderstandings, the mistranslations, the violence and the forced education of Indigenous peoples is all tied up with the romantic canon. We can't really disentangle those things. And we can go on insisting on an Anglophone approach to these things if we want to. We can go on saying we're just content to operate monolingually. But the colonial world was not a monolingual place. It wasn't, in fact, even a place of a sort of Tower of Babel. It wasn't a place where a lot of people spoke past each other in different languages. People were bilingual, multilingual. They operated in a complex linguistic world that we have forgotten, stamped out, eradicated, and are desperately trying to recover. So children like mine who are now in Māori immersion education, who are part of the generation who are fighting back against that and are the beneficiaries, in fact, of the work of their parents and grandparents to hold on desperately to languages and then to try and revive them, are living in that same moment. They are living in that moment of translation, of cultural genocide, of linguistic expression and literary expression that is desperately trying to hold on to traditional knowledge, trying to understand new knowledges, trying to express that through Indigenous languages. And so the fact that it's 150 years ago, 200 years ago, hardly matters. It's the same period, it seems to me. And that means we can draw lines from a moment like 1800, when Wordsworth's writing some of his major poems from the lyrical ballads. Fast forward to 20th century India, fast forward to 21st century New Zealand. These moments are all connected, and there's a way in which translation breaks down our temporal boundaries as well as our linguistic boundaries. There's a way in which it helps us see what I call in the book concordant moments, moments that are separated in time but chime together somehow. So I'm so grateful for the translators and linguists and knowledge keepers and community people who were prepared to talk to me about particular words, particular concepts. I'm grateful to the people I didn't meet but who had published in these areas, often in ways that are not really acknowledged by the academy, but the writing is there, the knowledge is there and publicly available. And I'm grateful to anyone who reads the book and sees something in it that helps them understand romantic literature better, helps them understand colonial life better. And if, like me, you're a settler scholar, maybe make something differently about the kind of work that is possible from within British Romantic Studies, within English Studies, within the training that we already have. Ngā mihi ki a koutou.